Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, Pardes alum. This week, Balak. Check out all of the electronic learning resources available to you from Pardes on lmod.pardes.org. There are other podcasts listed there, past podcasts, and other material as well. Check it out. This week, Balak with Rabbi Mike Feuer. Rabbi Mike Feuer is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Mike Feuer.
This week's Parsha, Parsha Balak, comes to teach us a lot about the power in a change in perspective. In this case, it really starts right from the beginning, when we see Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, and he's scared. The primary shift that Parsha gives us is that since the beginning of the book of Shemot, really we've been watching Am Yisrael in an almost internal camera perspective, if not through the eyes of Moshe, at least in the Am as a whole. And now suddenly we've gone from the internal to the external. We're looking at the story of the people from the outside. And what Balak sees scares him. You know, it wasn't exactly an uncommon phenomenon in the ancient world that some mass of semi-nomadic people would come rolling out of the wilderness and try to take the good green land of the people who had already settled there. And when he describes Israel in 22:4 as a horde that will lick clean all that is about as an ox licks up the grass of the field, he knows what he's talking about. And so it's an honest perspective, and the fear he feels is real. But what does this camera shift add to the internal story of Am Yisrael? I mean, after all, that is what the Torah is about. And we could have just as easily been told about what Balak did and how he reached for his ultimate weapon in Bilam, the cursor, from the outside. In fact, we hear that perspective later in the book of Micha, the prophet. If you look in the 6th chapter in the 5th line, it says, "My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, plotted against you and how Bilam, son of Beor, responded to him." Meaning, this serves as a reference in the relationship between people and God, not as an independent event. Why am I getting the first-hand perspective? Now, that pasuk, by the way, goes on. It says, "Recall your passage from Shittim to Gilgal, and then you will recognize the gracious acts of the Lord." And we'll get to the second half of that, the epilogue, in the end. But from now, the question we have is, what do you actually see from an outside perspective? Why does the Torah use this camera shift to teach us something about the story of Israel? Well, apparently, it wants us to see that story through Bilam's eyes. Now, after Bilam arrives and they get down to business, it says in Bamidbar 22:41, "In the morning, Balak took Bilam up to Ramot Baal. From there he could see a portion of the people. Vayar misham katzeh ha'am." Katzeh ha'am is a fascinating word. Katzeh is kind of a portion. It's also a bit of an edge. And as the Sforno actually says in that verse, "Vayar misham katzeh ha'am, in order that he should put his eye upon them." Let's know that the Mishnah in Avos in 5:22 says that the eye of Bilam is the archetypical evil eye. Just by seeing a bit of things, he's able to make them look bad. And by the way, we all know that, because it's always easy to make things look bad when we can frame a part of the picture as the whole. That's why something like decontextualizing is such a powerful tool for all propaganda. And like I said, the katzeh that he saw wasn't just the bit of it. It was also the edge. And the edge in specific is rarely the most attractive thing of any aspect of anything. Because almost by nature, it's constantly being maintained and therefore never really complete. And the people we are at the edge and the things we do are sometimes our best and sometimes our absolute worst. We're either sharp or brittle. But that's just the very fact that the Torah shifts its perspective and shows Am Yisrael a little bit to Bilam and that power of the evil eye. But it's not just how Bilam looks at things that teaches us something about the power of perspective in our Parsha. It's also what he says. Because the content in his curses, so-called, because they've come out as blessing, offers insights on what Am Yisrael is, the likes of which we don't find in the rest of the Torah. Now remember, Bilam is the prophet of the nations. And as such, he combines that sense of divine horizon, which the prophet is privileged to, together with a perspective from outside Israel. And Bamidbar Rabbah, the Rabbinic Midrash, says that Bilam was the non-Jewish parallel of Moshe. So he wasn't just any prophet. And according to Rashi, Bilam wasn't just a prophet. He was God's answer to the potential complaint of the nations that if they'd been given prophets, they would have been righteous like Israel just as well. So, meanwhile, that means that Bilam has been hired to curse, but he's not just any guy. He's the anti-Moshe, able to bring down death on Am Yisrael to the degree that Moshe had brought down life. But it doesn't work out that way. Like I said, God transforms his whole intention. Because after seeing a bit of the people and this strange ritual where Balak builds 7 altars and makes his offerings, Balaam gets his own lesson in perspective. In fact, in the perspective of how God sees Israel, otherwise than as an ox coming out to lick up the land. Here in 23, verses 8 and 9, it says, Ma'akov lo kavo el, uma ezom lo za'am Hashem. Right? How can I damn if God hasn't damned? How can I doom if the Lord hasn't doomed? Ki merosh tzurim er'enu u'migvo'ot ashurenu. From the mountaintops I see him. Gaze on him from the heights. He's not just seeing the edge anymore. It's the full picture. Hein am devadad yishkon uvagoyim lo yitchashev. They are a people that dwells alone, not reckoned amongst the nations. Now that phrase, people that dwells alone, I'm willing to bet, strikes a familiar chord. It's one of the more famous names that Am Yisrael gets, and it comes from the lips of the prophet of the non-Jews. I could tell you an entire story on that. If you want, by the way, you can send me an email to mikef@pardes.org.il, and I'll shoot you a different podcast I made just on that topic. But for now, just appreciate the fact that this is what Israel looks like from the outside. That's at the first chance. So once Balak sees that Balaam has actually blessed Am Yisrael, instead of cursing him like he wanted, he takes him around to another lookout to see a different piece of the whole. And there, in Balaam's second attempt to curse, he merits to see even more of how God looks at Israel. As it says, Lo hibit aven beYaakov velo ra'a amal beYisrael. Right? God doesn't see wrongdoing in Yaakov, nor any iniquity in Israel. And this is not divine blindness, because, of course, anyone who continues on in the Torah, and certainly throughout the Tanakh through the destruction, knows that God is not afraid to punish what he perceives to be the sins of Israel. This is not about how God sees us. It's about how he looks at us. It's a lesson that every parent knows, that if you choose to see the good in your children, then that's what you will indeed bring out in them. And God forbid, the opposite is true as well. Looking is never neutral. The perspective we have on things actually changes them. And so, there's a third round. Once Balaam once again fails to curse, and Balak curses him for it, they go around, build 7 more altars, and Balaam takes another try. Except, in this round, he actually changes his own perspective on the task at hand. Because the third time that Balak builds his altars and makes his sacrifices in hopes of solving his Jewish problem, Balaam has no intention of even trying to curse the people. As it says in 24:1, Vayar Balaam ki tov b'nei Hashem levarechet Yisrael, finally saw that it was good in the eyes of the Lord to bless Israel, as opposed to trying to curse and having it go back in his face. And now he turns his face toward the wilderness. Yisa Balaam et einav v'yar et Yisrael shochen l'shvatav. He looked up and he saw Israel encamped tribe by tribe, and the Spirit of God came upon him. It's a really different experience from the first two. And what he saw after lifting up his horizons was captured in words that we say every day as we enter the Beit Knesset, the synagogue, and ourselves try to see the world in a different light. Ma tovu olecha Yaakov mishkanotecha Yisrael. Right? Those beautiful words of greeting the tents of Jacob and the dwelling places of Israel. Oh, how good they are. And of course, Rashi brings the Gemara in a famous comment that what was it that triggered this vision for him? Well, he saw that the actual entrances of their tents were not exactly facing each other, meaning the perspective that Israel had on one another was one of modesty and respect. We don't look into each other's business. Life is better that way. Or, when Rashi brings a second comment from the Midrash, he says, Mishkanotecha, why is it called a mishkan, a tabernacle, which is very close linguistically to mashkon, which is a piece of collateral. How goodly are they, meaning those tabernacles, even when they're in ruins? Because then they are a pledge, mashkon, for you, and the fact that they are in ruins is an atonement for your souls. Meaning, that's a completely different perspective on history. When we look back at the destruction, we tend to mourn it. He's saying, rejoice, the reason that the buildings were destroyed is because the people were saved. So, this is just a drop in the bucket in the words of what Balaam saw. We could keep going into the power of the perspective that we find in his content. I mean, we didn't even talk about his messianic vision. But it's just a piece in that unique perspective that Parshat Balak offers us on how perspective is so powerful. One more. So Moshe wrote Parshat Balaam. That's a quote from the Talmud Bavli. It's in Baba Batra. By the way, you've got to look, starting at around 14b and going for at least a daf. There's a discussion in the Gemara and Baba Batra there about who wrote what book of the Tanakh. And by the way, some of the answers would get you kicked out of most of the Batei Midrash in Yerushalayim. But there, right at the beginning, it says, Mi Katvan, who wrote all these things? Moshe Katav Sifro Uparshat Bilam the Iyov. Right? Moshe wrote his book. Wonder which one that is. Parshat Bilam, the portion of Bilam, and the book of Iyov. I would love to go into Iyov right now, but I'm going to let it go. And for now, we're not really going to get into this question of what does it mean that Moshe wrote his book as opposed to what? But what I want to talk about is what is Parshat Bilam? You know, when you look at Rashi, which is always a good place to go if you want to know what the Gemara is talking about, he says, Nivuato u'mashalam, for his prophecy and his metaphors, Afal pish einan tzorche Moshe v'torato v'seder ma'asav, even though they really didn't bear on the needs of Moshe and his Torah, meaning the teachings he was giving the people, and the description of everything which had gone on, what we call history. Like I said, we could have just heard about this as a bit part to teach whatever lesson needed to be taught. But apparently it was Moshe that wrote down the first person perspective with which we're gifted. And that's fascinating, because I want to tell you about a place called Dir Allah. We're going to jump our perspective for a moment. Dir Allah is situated actually on the eastern side of the Jordan River. That's Western Jordan. About 8 kilometers east of the river and about a kilometer north of Yabuk, if you know where it is. And there, in the middle of the 20th century, archaeologists found a very large Bronze Age sanctuary, which had actually remained in use from then through the 5th century, the BCE, which is remarkable, by the way, that even despite at least one major destruction level, it showed continuous use. And in the midst of that complex, they found a cave. On the walls of that cave, they found in ink and paint what's known as the Bilam text. It's written in a language between Aramaic and Canaanite, and it's dated to at least 800 years before the Common Era. And the text refers to divine visions and imminent destruction in a language that is remarkably biblical. We hear about the Shaddai gods, El Shaddai. We see the use of the word Elohim, which of course, when we read biblical Hebrew, just as singular God, but as a plural group of gods. And here's just a little taste of what the text actually says. The misfortunes of the book of Bilam, son of Beor, a divine seer was he. The God came to him at night, and he beheld a vision in accordance with El's utterance. They said to Bilam, son of Beor, so will it be done with naught surviving. No one has seen the likes of what you have heard. That's just how it begins. But it goes on that when the people hear that destruction is imminent, perhaps coming from the wilderness, that they go to Bilam to save them, and he indeed, in his power as a divine seer, is able to do so. And then they rejoice, and there's some strange descriptions of the underworld. You can look it up, by the way, on livius.org. But what does it mean that we have these words attributed to Bilam, son of Beor? I mean, and by the way, he seems to be fulfilling the job that the Bible places in him quite well, better than he did at least facing Israel. So it's not only an extra biblical text, but we also have to add to that the perspective that in the eyes of the Gemara, at least, the Bilam eyes are a special project of Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, you know, the only answer to what that adds is depends on how you look at it. Okay, let's just do one epilogue to drive home how powerful the numerous perspectives on the power of perspective really is in Parshat Balak. Because at the end of the Parsha, the camera jumps back. And that's just in case you didn't notice. And suddenly we see what the people of Israel have been up to all this time that Bilam and Balak have been plotting against them. And when it comes back, things don't look so good. Or in another sense, things in particular were looking too good. The children of Israel are going astray after harlotry in that wonderful King James language. Lust and idolatry reign in the camp. And by the way, this is that second part from the verse from the prophet Micha that I said we'd come back to when it says, recall your passes from Shittim to Gilgal. This event is known as Chet Shittim, the sin at Shittim. Just imagine the ingratitude, because of course the verse finishes, then you will recognize the gracious acts of the Lord, meaning the fact that I didn't let Bilam destroy you. I mean, imagine it. God is transforming the curses of the most powerful evil sorcerer of all time into the best blessings ever. And meanwhile, Israel's chasing the women of Midian and bowing to their gods. No wonder the prophet was communicating wrath. right? Because this is, of course, also the moment of the ultimate spiritual rebellion in at least the Torah, when the tribe of Shivan comes to Moshe and says, you can't tell us it's forbidden to be with the women of Midian. Hey, you married a Midianite, didn't you? Don't tell us what to do. And then their prince takes a princess from the Midianites, and they go together to make a public display of their union. And of course, this is the event that triggers Pinchas, who rises up in his zealotry, grabs a spear and runs them through to, as we say, stay the wrath of the Lord and prevent total destruction. Now, there are a lot of perspectives on Pinchas out there and what it is that he did. And we could go into a whole discussion of whether this is right or wrong. I mean, on one level, I think we can all agree that the idea of spiritual rebellion on behalf of slavery to our base desires is bad. And I think we could probably agree that from a narrative perspective, if Pinchas hadn't stood up in that moment, total destruction may have ensued. I mean, at a certain point, you're going to get the last straw after the sin of the golden calf and the complaints and then the sin of the spies and then the rebellion of Korach. I mean, how much will it take? But nevertheless, if you're going to ask whether what Pinchas did was right or wrong, that's a matter of quite a bit of perspective. It's the ultimate violent act in holding the edge of the camp here. And I'm not actually going to add my perspective on right or wrong right now. Because really the last lesson that Parsha Balak has to teach us about the change in perspective, from the very camera shift itself to the idea of what Israel looks like from the outside through the eyes of a prophet nonetheless, to the strange notion of Moshe's particular authorship of the Parsha of Bilam when wedded to the fact that Bilam was actually a guy here in the neighborhood, to this final shift back to what Israel is up to in its ingratitude, there's one last lesson that Parsha Balak teaches us about the power of perspective, and that is the sages certainly understood that a storyteller makes his art by where he begins and where he ends. And if you've read the book before and you know how the story ends, appreciate the power of those sages who said, okay, but you're going to stop, and we'll talk about that next week. They understood the power that where you begin a story is not nearly as strong as where you end it.
Thank you, Rabbi Foyer. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.